I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Daisy is Careering. I'm Daisy Buchanan and this podcast is inspired by my brand new novel, Careering. It's a story about the complicated relationship between ambition and anxiety and what to do when you think your job might be the love of your life, but it's never going to love you back. Every episode, I'm going to be talking to a special guest about their own relationship with what they do for a living, how they've navigated the emotional highs and lows of their career, and how we can find a place for ourselves in a world where there is relentless outside pressure to succeed. How can we work on our own terms, and can we make work for us? In this episode, I'm talking to the award-winning presenter, campaigner and advocate Sophie Morgan, one of the first female TV presenters in the world with a physical disability. In her brilliant new book, Driving Forwards, Sophie courageously shares the details of her life before and after the event that changed everything forever. When she was 18 and on the brink of starting her adult life, Sophie was paralysed in a car crash and she had to rediscover herself and her dreams and ambitions. I loved having this conversation with Sophie, who was incredibly generous and honest about the emotional and practical challenges of working from a wheelchair. We talked about her work on the Paralympics, the fact that she's done my dream job, presenting crafts, and she even told me a tiny bit about her upcoming appearance on Bake Off. I hope you enjoy it. What did you want to be when you grew up?
There wasn't something specific, like a job or a certain role. It was more, I knew what kind of person I wanted to be. I wanted to be very free. I had a real aspiration to travel a lot and a real dream to step into the unknown. I certainly wanted to sort of shed the shackles of my life, or my parents being around or school or whatever. I felt really, really like, I just want to break free. I don't think I was a certain job. I was aspiring to be a lawyer, but I don't think that's because I wanted to be one. I was just told I should be one. So that was my rough plan.
I think it's so interesting, isn't it, that even when we're very, very young, we learn there's an appropriate answer to that question, and an answer that's not going to make anyone panic, and something that parents and teachers will be like, oh yes, of course. And if you do talk about, you know, not being sure, or I don't know, wanting to do anything different, I think people panic. And it's ironic because I think that so many of us are doing jobs and living lives that didn't exist in our parents' imagination or a teacher's imagination.
Yeah, I really agree with that, because I remember always at school I had a real passion and a love and a talent for painting and art, and I loved it so much, and it was never even considered. It wasn't like it was explicitly discussed. It was just sort of understood that that would never be pursued in the real world, you know. I would never become an artist of any kind. It was never going to be like that. That was always just like, well, no, you wouldn't do that because you've got the grades to be something better than that, in inverted commas, or something more conventional and bigger, or that had the potential to earn more money or something. It was just, so that's hence why I was sort of channeled down the lawyer route, because I had various grades that would have got me into that position. So it's right. And it's so limiting, isn't it? It's such a shame, which is why I was so grateful because I had my accident, I had the car crash that paralyzed me the night that I got my A-level results. And so that kind of pivotal point in your life where you're just about to step into adult life and become whoever it is you hope you're going to be, or maybe meant to be, however you want to look at it. I never, you know, at that point, everything changed. And I'm very grateful in many ways that it did, because I actually had that really sort of reflective perspective shift and went, actually, I'm just going to do the thing I really love. I don't care what anyone thinks. I don't care what my parents think. I don't care what, you know, the system would have wanted me to do. I'm going to do that art thing. So I actually did the art thing. I went to art school and no one cared at that point. Everyone was like, just do what you want to do, as long as you're happy, you know. But you're right, I think there's something about wanting to just conform or perhaps not rock the boat that happens so much for us and especially in our education system anyway here.
And I think, you know, for people sort of growing up and who were socialized as women as well, I was really like in awe of your accounts of wild behavior at school, because I was such a good little girl and I never dared to do any of those exciting things, certainly not until I was sort of well into my teens and everyone was at it.
I did push the boat a bit. I did, yes. It was something really like, I don't know, I just had to. It was that kind of, people ask me like, what, why were you like that? I'm like, I don't really know why, it just was.
Well, I think it's really interesting when you talk about your mum, who did lots of really different varied jobs and lots of really interesting jobs, from sort of being a nurse to dog breeding, and that friendship was such a central part of your mum's life. Sorry, I've completely forgotten the name of your mum's amazing friend, Sarah. Who sounds like an incredible, inspiring woman, Sarah.
Yeah, they were really strong role models for me. I think working mums, especially for me, not all of my friends had mums who worked. They definitely had dads who worked, but not all of their mums worked. And my mum worked from the minute I was born. She had I think she did two or three jobs at one point, maybe when I was a baby. I mean, obviously I don't remember, I wasn't aware at the time, but I remember her telling me she had like a paper round and then another job. She like juggled like three jobs or four jobs at one point. So she was always that, just, she had a really strong work ethic. And also her friends that she gravitated to were pretty much cut from the same cloth. And so these women that I grew up with were really, without knowing it, teaching me what it was that I might aspire to, in that sense of independence and potential. Like, but then I did find myself writing in the book. I observed that my mum had always been, she was a pilot, she was a stewardess, never a pilot, and she was a nurse, never a doctor. And I wondered if that's why she was always saying to me, "You can be anything you want," because I don't think she was told she could be anything she wanted. She was told she would just be what she was good enough for at the time. And I think she kind of fell into a lot of the work that came around. You know, it wasn't like she made a set plan and aimed for that. And she took what she had to make ends meet, and then upskilled as she went, because she was really good at what she did. But for me as her daughter, definitely her and her friends sort of instilled in us, we could do anything we wanted to do. It was quite amazing, really. Although that meant the sky was the limit. It was almost a bit overwhelming. If I can be anything, what do I be?
I think that's such an interesting and complicated conversation to have, that ambition is so exciting. And I do think that maybe in the sort of, you know, late 80s, early 90s, and still now, there's like, do anything, be everything. And it's so exciting, but also it's not okay to be ambitious. And I think when people tell us to be ambitious, what they mean is something that's, you know, like doing well at school, to kind of do it on our own terms. You know, how do we begin to break that down?
And when you start to write those rules for yourself, it's really quite overwhelming. Like, what do I really want, instead of what does society sort of think that I can do? But I get a real kick out of that. I think that's why I've led my life has led me down such a weird path. And I say weird because I don't really know any other word to describe it. I don't know how I've ended up where I've ended up. I know how I've ended up the person I am, but you know, my job and stuff, and like there was definitely no real set plan in becoming a television presenter. That just sort of evolved. But there was certainly a seed planted by my mum and my dad, of course, but and her friends and all those people that you've referenced that I put into the book, that sort of told me, sky's the limit, you can go where you want. As much as I didn't know what that meant, I knew I was super ambitious and knew I was super dedicated and motivated, so I was going to end up somewhere. Just didn't know where that was.
And it sounds as though, maybe, I really don't want to put words in your mouth, but you've chosen a job that, you know, makes all the use of your considerable skills, but it's also a way of kind of working to live. It's potentially an opportunity to travel. Like, you don't know what the next sort of phone call or email is going to bring, and you could, and you have been all over the world.
It's such a joy. I can't tell you, like, so there's pros and cons to the not knowing what email and what phone call you're going to get each day, because when nothing arrives or when you're sort of in that limbo, it's quite intimidating. And I think as a woman with a disability, I do like to feel safe. I like to feel like I've got enough money that I can look after myself, because we certainly can't lean on the benefit system, or we can't depend on support. And the cost of living as a disabled person is extraordinarily high. You know, a wheelchair costs more than a car, some examples. And so I've always felt very, very driven to make as much as I can just to look after myself. I don't mean I'm like really greedy. I just need enough to make sure I'm okay. And so my job kind of, when I started to see that it could support so many areas of my life that would otherwise be quite prohibitive. So like traveling or going to meet people or that I wouldn't otherwise normally, or go into places that I otherwise wouldn't normally. I think that's why I held onto it with both hands when I started to realize, oh gosh, this is a really, not only is it, I was never drawn to the television thing for like, oh, I want to be famous or anything. It was more like, I want a voice so that I can complain about being disabled and people will listen. I want a voice because disabled people don't have voices, and I'm really keen to change people's perception of what our lives are like. But I also, yeah, like you say, want to travel, and TV permits that. And I want to, you know, have a license to let my curiosity guide me into conversations that otherwise I wouldn't be able to. Or, you know, there's a lot of advantages that come with the job that make it such an exciting job, more than just the being on telly, way more than just the being on telly, you know?
I think that the challenges of you doing this brilliant work, presenting TV and not being there in sort of in a tokenistic way, but also can't fight the fact there must be so many young people who look at you and their eyes are opened in the possibility of what they can have and what they can imagine and who is out there in the world is different and broader in a brilliant way that maybe it wasn't 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, how do you sort of reconcile the fact that you represent hope to so many people, but also you do just want to be a TV presenter and do your job and go to work and not necessarily have to represent the hopes and dreams of...
Well, it's really kind of you to say it. I never really like to think of it being this sort of responsibility, because then it adds a huge amount of pressure, which, you know, I'm never going to be one person does obviously have the power to change the world, we all know that, but I don't feel like I've got the ability to do those things, and I just feel I'll do my bit for what I can. I've always felt very strongly about the shifting of perception, so I do embrace that side of the job. I think probably more than I probably should. Let me think about it clearly. I think it's more this idea that when I do get the feedback that somebody has like seen a show of mine and I'm on a motorbike and I'm traveling across the country and I'm not making much reference to my disability, and somebody sees it and says, wow, my daughter now has the confidence to, you know, go out more as a result or something. Of course, that hits home and means more than any other kind of feedback. And I can't imagine anyone else would feel differently if they were in the same situation. And I think it's led me to want to do more TV, but I can't also then sit there and say everything I do on television is altruistic, because like to the point I made earlier, I love all the benefits of being able to travel and being able to, but I think the problem is, and I've learned this over the years, is that if you are a minority and you're in the minority on television, there's so few disabled people represented, certainly represented accurately, and certainly I feel very privileged to be a handful of those people that are on screen. There's something really important about just communicating the ways in which our lived experience is so difficult. And I didn't want to have to do this work, but we have to. There's so few of us doing it, so we have to. I did, you know, they call it, there's so, it's not an unusual term to be familiar with, the idea of the accidental activist. You know, you don't necessarily want to be the advocate, but you kind of get asked to because there's so few of you on television. So I often, if I'm being interviewed, I find myself being asked, what's it like to represent disabled people? I'm like, I don't, but the fact that you're even asking me indicates I do, and indicates therefore that I must. And so there's this kind of like, it's a problem, because the truth is there are far, far, far too few disabled people on screen. I don't even need to pull out the stats to demonstrate and to validate my point, there are so few disabled people on television, certainly of colour or different backgrounds, or, you know, disability intersects every community, but yet we more often see white wheelchair users. The majority might be men, but, you know, certainly myself, like a white wheelchair user, it's like, as a woman, I think this is the thing, that the box ticking that happens, we all know happens. And I know that I've been a box ticker for time, and I know that I've tried to use that to my advantage and to be advantageous to my community as well. But there's pitfalls to that. So I just, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I get the chance to speak out. I get the chance to be heard. Like I said earlier, I wanted to raise the platforms to be heard. And so that when I complained about things, people would listen. Because when I first came out of hospital and I went to art school to try and enroll on a foundation course, I was told I couldn't go because there was no wheelchair access. And that was the first time in my life I'd, you know, ever encountered this experience of, no, you can't come in here. I was like, hey, what do you mean? And I was a wheelchair user. So they said, you, there's no access here. You can't come to college here. So I had to find a lawyer. I had to fight for my rights. I had to learn my rights. I had to know how to enforce them. You know, these were things I didn't know I had to do. And now I know them. And now I know full well how to protect myself. So it's this kind of, that was the day I realized that there was always going to have to be this fight. There was always going to have to be this constant need to advocate for my rights and advocate for other people's rights. Because if we don't, then who will? And yeah. But I think it does come back to the point that it does, the job does come with a responsibility. And no matter how much I might, you know, at times think, oh, I'd just rather just do my job, I actually really enjoy taking that responsibility and doing it correctly when I can. And not thinking of it as too much of a burden and trying to get it, you know, like if I mess up or if I don't do it right.
I read an interview that I thought was really interesting where you talk quite openly about having sort of quite a difficult start to the pandemic and having all of these plans and being at a really, really exciting point in your career. And lots of things fell through. And my untrue assumption is always anyone who's like on TV is massively sort of glossy.
It's funny how everyone thinks that. I wish I could change that. For the 80% of us that are on television at my level anyway, it's definitely not secure.
Well, I found it quite moving, quite inspiring to sort of hear someone with your success and your position say, no, I've had professional disappointments, this did not go my way, and I don't feel, you know, powerful or in control. I think it's quite oddly liberating to know, you know, not in a kind of, I don't want to ever revel in anyone's misfortune, but I think that for lots of people, especially when you do a career where you are very, very, very visible, and I think, you know, it's an extension of, I suppose, what we often feel on social media, that we think everyone is experiencing these sort of these great career triumphs, and we're not. I mean, I've noticed it so much in terms of the work I do. I try to limit Instagram, especially. I find quite overwhelming. And honestly, people can have like lovely houses and fabulous holidays, and, you know, I don't have children. I'm not sure that's something I want to do. You know, people have babies, people living their sort of their fabulous lives, and I sincerely think good for them. And then when I say it's like, oh, they've got a really like exciting new job, massive book deal, award, that's when I feel envy squeezing my heart. And, you know, I've written a few books. I really like my job. I have a very nice time. I don't know what it is. And like, even when it's someone, like, you know, someone's won an award because they're an architect, I'm like, that's not something that is ever going to come up for me.
I think it's just that good old imposter syndrome or something that makes you think, I don't know, I can't speak for you, but for me, I totally empathize with that. And I totally sympathize. It's just that feeling of like, oh, have I done enough in my area? Am I pushing myself? Especially like, just going back to our earlier point about ambition. If you're an ambitious person, which I assume you are, as I am, it's that kind of like, oh, have I not gone that one extra mile? Do I need to just go a little bit further so I can be at peace when I go to sleep? Is it enough? Am I enough? Have I done enough? I think it riddles us with anxiety about where we are. And like you say, even when you are looking at yourself in the mirror and going, actually, you've done a good job here. You've done the thing. Or you move the goalposts and you are like, well, hold on, I didn't win an award for it. Hold on a minute. I'm not, you know what I mean? And it's just that niggling voice. But I recognize also that voice is probably the same voice that the one that's saying, keep going, keep going, keep going, which is what ambition is all about. And so I kind of, you can't silence that former voice without the latter being silenced. You know, they come hand in hand, perhaps. I don't know. But to your question and observation about television and the job, and so yes, I did. So when the pandemic happened, I was at a point in my career where I had worked my absolute hardest to get where I was. And when I say that, to explain what that means in television terms, I had been doing the work. I had, like, the jobs that I had been lucky enough to get, I had put my absolute all into, like, learning the craft, trying to do the best I can, working hours and hours and hours to the detriment of my disability at times, and really doing what I can to just make sure I just always get another job, you know, because it's always about, there's no guarantee you're going to get another job. So it's that, always that, right, did I do it good enough? Will it be good enough to get me another job? Let's wait and see. I don't know if I'm going to get that email. So there's that going on for a long, long time. I mean, most of my television career has been like that. And yes, I have had some high profile, and, like, for example, the Paralympics, where I was fronting the Paralympics. That didn't guarantee that I would do anything else but the Paralympics. I might not even do the Paralympics the next time around. They might select someone else. So there's no, they didn't feel like security. Or certainly I didn't know, for me, it didn't feel like security. For other people, that might've been enough, but I've always been quite anxious and nervous about it. So it felt so tenuous. It felt like, oh gosh, this is so close. And it felt so precious to hold on to. Like, I was like, I'm not lucky enough to hold on to this. This has got to go. I'm obviously quite pessimistic, I suppose, because of what's happened to me in my life. I'm always a bit like, the next big drama is around the corner.
When you're actually presenting at the Paralympics, you know, being there, were you able to kind of at least enjoy the moments of it?
I was, and I got, there was a moment when I got the job, and I remember where I was and what I was doing, and I was sitting in Hyde Park. I had just finished the audition. There'd been a lot of us auditioning for this job, and I was so excited to get it. So hoping to get it, and I got it. And I remember I was in my chair sitting in the park on the way home, and I remember thinking, my life's about to change. It's going to change. My life is going to change, and in the best way. And I didn't know what it meant, or what, I had no idea what that could actually mean, because I hadn't lived it yet. But I knew everything was going to change. Not just like I'd make some money. It was like, I'm going to be part of this wave of a Paralympic movement, which is really exciting for me as a paraplegic and as a disabled person. But also, I'm going to go on one of the most widely watched programs in the world. And what is that going to be mean? What's that going to mean? Because I, like I said, I've been looking for opportunities to present. But for wheelchair users like me, there weren't that many opportunities to present. You were often told, we don't want, you know, why would you present this subject? People are going to need to know why you, because you're a wheelchair user. So unless it's about disability, you're not really going to, viewers aren't going to like it. You're going to have to explain your disability. And if the subject isn't about disability or about you or about something to do with you, they're just not going to like it. Because disabled people, this was a while ago now, obviously, before the 2012, 2016 games, that window of time. There wasn't that many opportunities. So when I did get that chance, and then I lent into the career and tried to push to go further and further and further, it was always hard work. It was never a shoo-in. The door was slightly open, but there was a glass ceiling. There's a glass ceiling for all women in television. There are barriers there in the same, you know, way that would be for me, for a woman who was not disabled. But I also had that door opening because I was a wheelchair user and boxes needed to be ticked. And I knew that. So I was like, right, I'm going to get in here and try and then prove my worth and stay in the job. But this is what I was trying to say earlier. It had always been a graft, like a push, like meetings after meetings, trying to convince people to believe in me or show, you know, choke to like, get, and I get a job and I've got to do it at my best. And it was all that, right? Same as any job. Anyway, I've been grafting for about 2 or 3 years to try and get a particular idea off the ground. And when I say it took 3 years, I mean, it literally took 3 years of meetings, pushing, project, like it was long. And this idea finally got off the ground. And I had put all of my eggs into that basket. It was going to be huge. I was going to be riding a motorbike around the world to go to the Tokyo 2020. What was the year that Tokyo was meant to happen? I can't even remember now. Yeah, the 2020 again. Yeah.
Oh, it must have been 2020.
Okay. How can we forget? So I was meant to be arriving in Tokyo on my motorbike, and I was going to be followed by Channel 4 and make this big documentary series. It was going to be absolutely the greatest thing I could ever achieve. And it got cancelled. And I didn't get a phone call to say, you know, don't worry, it will happen again. I just got the same as all of us. We don't know what's going to happen. And I couldn't handle, like, I was like, oh my God, all of these years I've worked for this thing, and I didn't have any other jobs lined up because that was going to be my job for the next 6 months. So was that? And there was no security. There was no like, oh, don't worry. I mean, who knows what could have happened after that? So I was as vulnerable as anybody else. And because my job involved going out and about, and when the lockdown happened, I was completely stranded.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
And then on top of that, there was the pandemic, there was the unsurety, the insecurity around my disability and whether my specific disability would weather COVID. We didn't know at the time. And then there was my relationship breaking down, and then I ended up on with some secondary complications of my disability. It all just came boom, 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 one after the other. And yeah, so I got to, you know, I thought I was going to be riding high at the peak of my career. And then I was just, no, off you go, drop. So I have been incredibly grateful since the pandemic finished and some jobs have come open, and now it is dominoing and I'm really in a good place because I know how fragile it is and how quickly it can be lost. And the other truth of it is I have a physical disability, and if it decides to get in the way, all of this dries up. So I have no, you know, if I fall and break my leg, I can't sit in my chair. I can't go to work. So it is really... I'm very grateful every day that I get to go to my job, because I don't know if I will be able to one day. So it's like, yeah, I think to what you said about the television thing, everyone thinks it's really secure. I'll tell you now, if you speak to, there's a certain percentage of talent that will always be safe, but there's a large percentage of talent that I've worked with and I know well, and we all kind of at the same level or probably a little bit higher than me, that are, you know, can be out of work for months or then can suddenly get a job. And everyone just thinks it looks so glitzy and safe and great, lots of money and all this stuff. But it's not my experience of it, actually. It's a lot of work to try and keep yourself in the room. And then, you know, to try and keep coming back, you know, time after time with new shows. People get bored. People want new talent. It's hard.
I was really struck by something you said a little bit earlier about to do those jobs, because as you say, it's that needing to be called back and no, just needing to be in someone's eye line for long enough to get the next phone call, and how challenging it must be when you've got to a point. Push your body beyond where you should be pushing it in terms of how active you are and, you know, how much rest you need and everything, but having to sort of negotiate that into how much you know to sort of how you can wear yourself out or not when you need to pull back. That must be another really challenging thing to keep negotiating.
I think it's something I've only just learnt, or maybe it's only because I'm safe enough now. Maybe no, I'm actually going to argue with myself. Even now, I find myself pushing myself too far because I still don't think I'm safe enough to go to anyone, no, I won't do that because my disability might get in the way. I find it really hard because I'm terrified of someone saying, oh, don't employ her. She's got a disability that's going to make her harder to work with. And that is an ableism that exists outside of me, but inside of me. And I always battle with, because I wish that I could trust that my employer would be flexible and accommodating and meet my needs and not feel that I'm too much of a burden. But the reality is I worry about it all the time. And I think I'm not alone in that that's one of the reasons why disabled people often keep their disabilities to themselves, if it's a bit an invisible disability, as we, you know, often refer to them, because you're worried. You're worried that you're going to get stigmatized and people are going to think you're not productive, or that think that you're not able to do your job well because your disability is going to get in the way. There's a reason why disabled people are so, that the unemployment rate is so high. And it's not that we should ignore our, you know, our bodies and push ourselves. We really, really shouldn't. It's just the fear is there. And I'm very aware of how unfair that is. I'm very aware of how wrong that is. And I know, as the advocate myself, I would say to other disabled people, no, be proud, say what you need. Do it, but it's hard. I mean, there's times when I've done it, but I felt very uncomfortable. It's a very difficult thing to do. And until the world becomes a far more forgiving and empathetic place, I just don't know how we bring our full disabilities to the workplace without feeling slightly worried that the people around us are going to judge us for not being the same as everybody else. And it's a sad fact, but I think we're working on it. And there's some amazing work being done out there to validate the fact that disabled people, even if they, you know, can't work for the full hours, or they've got a chronic illness that impacts the way in which they approach work, doesn't mean that they can't work as well. You know what I mean? And that changing that perception is so important. It's being done for sure. But I know, just being honest, that I know what I'm like. And I found it over the years really hard to bring that forward without feeling slightly scared. But definitely getting better at it. I'm just not perfect at it yet.
That's another big thing to ask of yourself. And I think, you know, what you said about sort of the nature of the work is not secure. All I want for everyone who is employed to be able to say what they want and what they need. But I understand why people don't do that and don't feel that they can do that. And I think that over the last 2 years, what everyone has gone through is the sort of, you know, even kind of outside your work, but in, you know, sort of traditional offices and shops and factories and all the workplaces, I think they're all set up to squeeze us.
They but don't haven't we accommodate. Just wonderfully demonstrated that we can be flexible and we can adapt? I mean, when the pandemic happened and everyone started working from home, certainly within my community, everyone was going, look, we've been telling you for years people can accommodate workers from home. Look what you've just done. Now, you know, it's not ideal and not everyone wants to work from home. But for those people who have to work from home or need to work from home or might occasionally prefer to work from home, the pandemic validated all of those arguments. And it was like, oh my gosh, look, we've proven it. So, yeah, I feel like we learned a lot from the pandemic about the way in which we can adjust to meet people's needs. But whether we implement those learnings and move back and, you know, make it easy is yet to be seen. Doesn't really feel like it.
I think you're right. I think it's a work in progress, and I think things will change and they have to. But I think that it is quite, it's, I think it's very much connected with the way we think about work and how there is part of us all that fetishizes this idea of, you know, the dream job and doing something glamorous and fabulous and exciting. And also the other part of us thinks work needs to be miserable and an ordeal and the awful thing that punctuates our lives, so we can, you know, we have to be miserable in the week to enjoy the weekend. And that seems like a really archaic way of thinking too.
I don't know, it's something I constantly reflect on, is this idea of like, I don't want to spend my time, because I nearly died when I had my car accident. I do feel I live this with this sort of like, I don't want to waste any time. I know that feels like a very privileged comment when you're like, just do what you love. You know, it's like, it's more complicated than that. But I do really feel like in the heart of my decisions, I try and do the stuff that I really, really love, because it matters. It is the thing. I don't want to have to wait till the weekend to be happy, because life's tough. And living with a full-time disability, quite a severe physical disability, is tough enough. So if I can find a way to enjoy the thing that I do, then I've got to try and do that. But yeah, there are some very archaic ideas around work that I hope, like you say, are a work in progress that we'll move away from. Whenever I talk about my work and I love my job. I think that's one of the things I always want to hammer home, of we don't need to be, well, again, I know it's a kind of privileged position to come from, but that believing that work has to be hard or awful or miserable or really, you know, we need to get rid of that.
I would love to ask you about two jobs you've done that I think, look from the outside like utter dream jobs, other than things we talked about. And I'm really, I've not seen, it's not been on yet, has it? I'm so excited about you on Bake Off, which is just my favourite thing in the whole world, that show. It's going to be amazing. And I imagine that you cannot tell me
much.
What
can I tell you? It's a celebrity special. So I don't want to get myself in trouble, but it was really fun. And I'm a terrible baker, but I had a really good time. It was really fun. And I don't even know what, I haven't seen the edit, so I don't even know what made it in. So again, I can barely comment on it, but it was really fun. But I'm not a massive Bake Off fan. So I was a bit like, what's the big deal, right? When everyone was like, oh, I'm going to be on Bake Off. Everyone was like, what? And I was like, is that a big deal? Is this, oh my God. You know what I mean? Some people that love Bake Off are like, it's huge. So I came back with like an apron signed by everyone to give to my friends, or I got a rolling pin from the guys and got that signed to give to another friend who's a Bake Off fan, because it's like an institution. Everyone's so obsessed with it. So it was such a, when I was there, I really got why. It was really, really fun. And obviously Noel and Matt and all those, the lovely judges are just so lovely. Had a great time.
I love that so much. And I love this idea that sort of the people around you and finding out kind of, you know, what they love and what they notice and what they're engaged in, when you're like, oh my God, you're doing that job. Because the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is crafts.
Honestly, it's so funny you say that. Because I do these random jobs, so many random different jobs. And I always find like it's so telling, the people that actually watch them when I do Loose Women, that you'd be so surprised. The people that message me and say, great job on Loose Women. My dad just told me you were on it. It's a lot of dads watch Loose Women. I always thought that was really funny. I know. It's like, it's not my mom watched you or I watched you. It's my friends messaged me saying my dad saw you on Loose Women, which I think is really funny. And Crufts is literally, I can't tell you how many messages they've got. Everybody watches it. It's just the best because it's so sweet and lovely. And at this time when everything feels so miserable and horrible, rightly so, the world is just in a terrible place, isn't it? It's like the best escapism being up there. I really enjoyed it. Although I had a really unusual allergic reaction to the dogs. There was 26,000 dogs there. And on day two, I started to notice my eyes were like, I can barely open my eyes. I was like, oh, no, this is terrible. I can't be a Crufts presenter with and allergic to dogs. It's just terrible. So, but it was a dream. It was wonderful. And also working with the one and only Claire Balding. Like, oh, wow. She's just,
wow.
I mean, Radzi as well, who's the other presenter. He's a brilliant presenter and so fun to work with and just lovely and very, he's just a great, great vibe. He's just got lovely energy about him. And then there's Claire. It's like, oh my gosh, that's how it's done. You know, I just sit and watch her like, oh, how is she so good at her job? I mean, when you know her skills and her, because of the techniques that she has, and she's the top of her game. She's just amazing to work with. So it's a brilliant, brilliant job. And also the team at Channel 4, they're the best of the best. And I'm so, so, and just so lucky to be a part of those teams, because it's a similar team that does the Crufts that does the Paralympics. So that's kind of how I crossed over. It was a brilliant job to be involved in.
Because it must be intense and challenging because it's so much live TV.
Yeah, mash.
Dogs are not, I mean, these dogs possibly more predictable than your average dog, and they're very well trained.
Oh, no, there's a reason they say never work with dogs.
Who
and
knows
animals.
What they're going to do?
Dogs and children or whatever it is. Never work with kids. But it was hard. I find live television really, really intimidating still. I whenever I do it, which isn't often, unfortunately, it's probably why I feel it so intimidating. It's just extremely overwhelming. And I had just had COVID the week before. So I was a bit like, where am I? Oh my gosh, I'm on TV. There's a dog. What are we doing? Right. You know what I mean? I was like, wow, it's a really wild job. Really fun. But it sort of feels like strap in. Here we go. Oh, you're on a roller coaster and you're not getting off for the next few hours because you're on air. It's like that. It's really, I don't know how to describe it. Perhaps it's something similar to being on stage, you know, like a performer of some sort, but it's wild just sitting there and you're knowing that there's all these people at home watching you, and I'll never get used to it. Never get used to it, I don't think.
I do think that's so interesting though, that you're there, you know, presumably sort of knackered after COVID, fighting the allergies and still having to be like, no, I've got to show up.
And be like on your top form and smile, you know, and yeah, it's just this is the thing about working in television. It's sort of like, it's the same as any other job in the sense that you've got to turn up when you're tired. You've got to turn up when you're just a little bit sick, or you've got to crack on and, you know, you've got to put in the hours, but yet people are watching you do it. Like, most people don't get watched at work apart from by their colleagues, but I'm like, you know, my friends are watching, or my, I don't know, friends of friends or people I went to school with or something, and you're like getting these messages, you're like, oh my god, you're watching me right now, it's so weird.
It's not the same as turning up on Friday with a hangover ever, and just like hunkering down to your emails.
I've made the mistake of turning up to work with a hangover on television. Big mistake. You only do that once. It is so bad. It's not so, yes, you can't get away with that. Well, I certainly can't. I don't feel like I can.
What would you like to do next? Do you have any sort of, you know, like hopes or dreams? Or
I definitely do.
Things that you'd really like to happen next few years?
I'm about to start filming another series of this show that I made, which is called Living Wild: How to Change Your Life.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, I'm so glad that's coming back.
Thanks so much. It's coming back. I'm so excited. That's literally life made. I'm so, so excited to have my own show. So that starts filming next Monday, a week today. And that goes on for the next 2 or 3 months. And then I think I really want the book to do to succeed in its own way. I don't know what that means. So I haven't really set my metrics for success yet. I don't know if it's X amount of sales or whether it's X amount of feedback. I just don't know what I want, but I want it to live in the world in a way that makes it, all the hard work worth it, and all the toil, the blood, sweat and tears worth it. And then I was thinking about writing potentially a screenplay. I've had some people interested in doing that with me, which would be really exciting, a whole new world. And then lastly, I feel like I want to move to the States and work in America, because there's very little representation of disabled people on screen in the States, and I would love to try and shift that dial there. I don't know why, it's just something I've been thinking about. They've got the 2028 games coming to LA, and then there's, you know, Hollywood there and all this sort of powerful, the industry feels like it's at its hub there when it comes to, you know, representation on screen. There's no greater place to try and move that. So I keep thinking that's where I'd like to go. No idea what I'd do there. No idea. I just putting it out there. That's probably where I'd like to end up.
I think it's so exhilarating to say that out loud. Even now, I get quite anxious and quite nervous about having the audacity to say, and I've got stuff coming up where it's probably going to be fine. But I'm like, absolutely, yeah. I fear the jinx, like as soon as it's sort of out of my mouth. Yeah. And I'm like, it probably won't happen, but, and sort of all these caveats. And I can't drive. And whenever I was learning, I was really bad at it, because if I saw like an oncoming car, I'd panic. And in my panic, I'd be like steering to the car. And I think that's it. If you start, I'm not going to sort of be promoting, you know, manifestation and visualization, but I do think that to a point that being able to see and conceive and imagine your goals, you will angle yourself there.
That's a really lovely way of putting it. I think that's a really beautiful way to put it, because I'm with you. I'm a bit wary of the manifestation thing and the whole, you know, that I don't know how I feel about that, but let's not go into that because we don't need to. I think it's more about just putting the intention there and thinking, well, let's just see. It's not like I booked a flight to, well, I did actually book a flight to LA, but it's not like I've made that goal to, instead of setting goals, I keep trying to think of how I can grow, right? So it's not like I'm saying, oh, I want to be on television in America. I want to be a presenter in America. I actually say things like, where can I grow from here? And maybe there'll be a point where I think what I've achieved in the UK is at a cap. And maybe I need to go to somewhere else where there's more opportunity. What that opportunity is, I don't know, but that I feel that might be something that happens. And, and I've spoken to people that have said that to me, you know, you can achieve more here than or even more here. You've achieved a lot here, but you can achieve more there, so come over here and keep going. So that kind of, it's more, or if I say the thing about the screenplay, it's not like I've set a goal that I know is an actual clear target. It's more like, well, hold on, if I've done writing to this level, maybe I could grow and do writing at that level, and maybe I could then learn a skill there. So it's this sort of, it's a development. It's a step in the right, a step in the new direction, always moving forward, always sort of like feeling that you should, you know, push yourself without it being too prescriptive or too like, this is the thing I need to do. I want this, because I think you kind of can set yourself up to fail a little bit. And I don't know if goals always suit everybody. I don't feel like I'm a goal orientated, but I just, like I say, I'm a sort of, the growth thing works for me. Like, right, how do I grow? How do I just keep going bigger and better? And it's like personal development almost.
Really, really interesting. And I think that goals can feel quite daunting and also quite rigid. And the thing I'm trying to do is to do things with the spirit of curiosity and just think,
yeah,
where might I go?
That's totally what I mean. Absolutely. And it's that lovely feeling of like, okay, I think I'm ready. I don't know if I'm good enough, but I'm going to hope I am. I'm just going to just try. And it's also the goal thing, I think, with, we become quite goal orientated. I think, I don't know when that started to happen, but I certainly started to notice it. Everyone talks about goals, you know, your goal weight or your goal job or your dream is. And I'm like, I also think it's really dangerous for people, because then if you say something happens to you and you don't reach those things, are you always going to be miserable? And like, we go back to your original point, like, what did you want to be when you grow up? And then you're not that thing. You're like, oh, did I fail? And I think that's really unhelpful. I think it's more like, what could you possibly believe you could do? And just lean into that curious of like, okay, maybe I could dream so big as to, for example, this is what I did a few years ago, have my own show. Like, could I try and do that? So that was, I don't know, if I didn't say I'm going to have my own show. I was like, could I possibly have that conversation? Yeah, I could probably have that conversation with someone who might be able to make that happen. If they said, you're not ready, I go, okay, I'm not ready. You know what I mean? So it was almost just like a tentative dip your toe in, but make sure you do, because you, if you don't, then it's like you've wasted that opportunity, you know? And so it's almost like making the opportunity without setting yourself up to fail. Because if I didn't get that job and it didn't happen, I go, well, I tried and, you know, I did my best, but it wasn't right. It wasn't the right time. So I think that's a far kinder way to like keep moving forward than set a specific target. Because what if you miss and then you feel like you've ruined your life, or you feel like you've let yourself down? No, we don't have time for that. There's no need for that. You know, life's tough enough as it is.
Quite. And I think so many no's are not yet, that just because that very specific thing doesn't happen at that very specific time, who knows, you know, where things will lead.
Absolutely. And I think as well, going again to that same point about, if you're an ambitious person, you might jump too far ahead or aim too far ahead and actually you're not ready yet. And it's just like, no, just wait until, you know, because I know, for example, that America dream, I'm not there yet. I've still got stuff to do. It's just potentially one day there could be that. And I don't know where it's come from, whether I planted the seed or somebody else has, it's just there. But I'm definitely not going to say, by the time I'm 45, I need to be living in LA and I need to have made a film, because it's just not the way I work. I don't want to do that to myself, because if I get to 45, I've had a really difficult few years. Something happened with my spinal injury and I knocked myself off and I couldn't, you know, work and I couldn't do those things. Or my mum got sick and I had to go and look after her. Would I be then riddled with what if? And I hate what if. I like, okay, well, you could have, but you know, you didn't. So there's something else that you did, something else happened, and have that fluidity and flexibility. Because if we've learned anything in the last few years, the unexpected happens all the time. And I think we just need to be a bit more kind to ourselves, especially like, to, again, going back to you, what you were saying about Instagram, seeing other people's lives. Is that your goal or is that their goal? And I think we're so riddled with, at the moment, with this sort of competitive, and I that's just such a dangerous space to be, certainly as a disabled woman. I don't want to be competitive with anyone, because it's just it's just impossible. So I feel like actually just try not to push those unachievable goals, and just make, always keep your mindset a growth mindset.
I love that. I love Carol Dweck. I was really struck by, I think this is her, and I might be paraphrasing horribly, but about how when you're a child, if you're told you're clever, you take fewer risks because you do not want to compromise that cleverness. And if you're not defined by that, you feel like you've got more room to get it wrong. And you're more curious, and the growth of being just sort of able to kind of move and try and figure it out. I could talk to you about this subject for like another hour at least. And I know you're very busy and you have a lot to do. So I'm going to finish by asking what I ask everyone, which is, what does the phrase dream job mean to you?
For me, the dream job, when I'm in my dream job, I almost feel like it couldn't get any better, if that makes sense. So like, So for example, this travel series, I'm sitting on my motorbike traveling through the west of Scotland. This happened last summer. And I've got a drone following me. I've just been and met this amazing family. I'm living this. It was perfection. It was the dream. And I remember thinking, okay, if I never work another day in this job, and if I never get this again, and it never happens again, this is the dream. It's like, I can never get, I know I'm at the pinnacle of my potential. And I'm proud I got here. anything else is from just a bonus from here. That's what dream job feels like to me.
Can I cheers that? Because that is beautifully put. That is a glorious, glorious so. Feeling.
I hope truly that makes sense. Thing.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Huge thanks to Sophie. Her book, Driving Forwards, is out now and it's excellent. Honest, inspiring, life-affirming and written with so much humour and heart. Thank you so much for listening to Daisy is Careering. The podcast is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast with special thanks to Sphere. My novel Careering is published by Sphere and out now, available in hardback from all online bookshops with a special signed edition available from Waterstones. It's also available from Amazon where you can find the ebook and the audiobook read by Celine Buckins and Joe Hartley. For now, I leave you with this from Nora Ephron about how we use work and ambition to define ourselves. We have a game we play when we're waiting for tables in restaurants where you have to write the five things that describe yourself on a piece of paper. When I was in my 20s, I would have put ambitious, Wellesley graduate, daughter, Democrat, single. 10 years later, not one of those five things turned up on my list. I was journalist, feminist, New Yorker, divorced, funny. Today, not one of those five things turned up in my list. Writer, director, mother, sister, happy. See you next time. We'll be right back.